To have a madman with thoughts of blood and theft in his head sitting just 10 inches in front of you and not to know it, not to have a hint even what blindness you people are capable of. Here you are, sitting in glass buildings and talking on the phone night after night to Americans who are thousands of miles away, but you don't have the faintest idea what's happening to the man who's driving your car. What is it, Balram? Just this, sir. That I want to smash your skull open. He leaned forward. He brought his lips right to my ear. I was ready to melt. I understand, Balram. I closed my eyes. I could barely speak. You do, sir? You want to get married? Balram, you'll need some money, won't you? Sir, no. There's no need of that. Wait, Balram. Let me take out my wallet. You're a good member of the family. You never ask for more money. I know that other drivers are constantly asking for overtime and insurance, but you never say a word. You're old-fashioned. I like that. We'll take care of all the wedding expenses, Balram. Here, Balram. Here's... I saw him take out a 1,000-rupee note, put it back, then take out a 500, then put it back, and take out 100, which he handed to me. I assume you'll be going to Laxmangar for the wedding, Balram. Maybe I'll come along, he said. I really like that place. I want to go up to that fort this time. How long ago was it that we were there, Balram? 6 months ago? Longer than that, sir. I counted the months off on my fingers. 8 months ago. He counted the months, too. Why? You're right. I folded the 100-rupee note and put it in my chest pocket. Thank you for this, sir, I said, and turned the ignition key. Early next morning I walked out of Buckingham Bee onto the main road. Though it was a brand new building, there was already a leak in the drainage pipe, and a large patch of sewage darkened the earth outside the compound wall. 3 stray dogs were sleeping on the wet patch. A good way to cool off. Summer had started, and even the nights were unpleasant now. The 3 mutts seemed so comfortable. I got down on my haunches and watched them. I put my finger on the dark sewage puddle. So cool, so tempting. One of the stray dogs woke up, yawned and showed me all its canines. It sprang to its feet. The other mutts got up too. A growling began, and a scratching of the wet mud, and a showing of teeth. They wanted me off their kingdom. I surrendered the sewage to the dogs and headed for the malls. None of them had opened yet. I sat down on the pavement. No idea where to go next. That's when I saw the small dark marks in the pavement. Paw prints. An animal had walked on the concrete before it had set. I got up and walked after the animal. The space between the prints grew wider. The animal had begun to sprint. I walked faster. The paw prints of the accelerating animal went all the way around the malls, and then behind the malls, and at last, where the pavement ended and raw earth began, they vanished. Here I had to stop, because 5 feet ahead of me a row of men squatted on the ground in a nearly perfect straight line. They were defecating. I was at the slum. Vitiligo Lips had told me about this place. All these construction workers who were building the malls and giant apartment buildings lived here. They were from a village in the darkness. They did not like outsiders coming in, except for those who had business after dark. The men were defecating in the open like a defensive wall in front of the slum, making a line that no respectable human should cross. The wind wafted the stench of fresh shit toward me. I found a gap in the line of the defecators. They squatted there like stone statues. These people were building homes for the rich, but they lived in tents covered with blue tarpaulin sheets and partitioned into lanes by lines of sewage. It was even worse than Laxmangar. I picked my way around the broken glass, wire and shattered tube lights. The stench of feces was replaced by the stronger stench of industrial sewage. The slum ended in an open sewer, A small river of black water went sluggishly past me, bubbles sparkling in it, and little circles spreading on its surface. Two children were splashing about in the black water. A 100-rupee note came flying down into the river. The children watched with open mouths, and then ran to catch the note before it floated away. One child caught it, and then the other began hitting him, and they began to tumble about in the black water as they fought. I went back to the line of crappers. One of them had finished up and left, but his position had been filled. I squatted down with them and grinned. A few immediately turned their eyes away. They were still human beings. Some stared at me blankly as if shame no longer mattered to them. And then I saw one fellow, a thin black fellow, was grinning back at me as if he were proud of what he was doing. Still crouching, I moved myself over to where he was squatting and faced him. I smiled as wide as I could. So did he. He began to laugh, and I began to laugh, and then all the crappers laughed together. "We'll take care of your wedding expenses," I shouted. "We'll take care of your wedding expenses," he shouted back. "We'll even fuck your wife for you, Balram. We'll even fuck your wife for you, Balram." He began laughing, laughing so violently that he fell down face first into the ground, still laughing, exposing his stained ass to the stained sky of Delhi. As I walked back, the malls had begun to open. I washed my face in the common toilet and wiped my hands clean of the slum. I walked into the parking lot, found an iron wrench, aimed a couple of practice blows, and then took it to my room. A boy was waiting for me near my bed, holding a letter between his teeth as he adjusted the buttons on his pants. He turned around when he heard me. The letter flew out of his mouth and to the ground. The wrench fell out of my hand at the same time. "They sent me here. I took the bus and train and asked people and came here." He blinked. "They said you have to take care of me and make me a driver too."
"Who the hell are you?"
"Dharam," he said. "I'm Lutu Auntie's fourth son. You saw me when you came to Laxmangar last time. I was wearing a red shirt. You kissed me here." He pointed to the top of his head. Picking up the letter, he held it out to me. "Dear grandson, it has been a long time since you came to visit us, and an even longer time, a total of 11 months and 2 days, since you last sent us any money. The city has corrupted your soul and made you selfish, vainglorious and evil. I knew from the start that this would happen because you were a spiteful, insolent boy. Every chance you got, you just stared at yourself in a mirror with open lips, and I had to wring your ears to make you do any work. You are just like your mother. It is her nature, and not your father's sweet nature, that you have. So far we have borne our sufferings patiently, but we will not do so. You must send us money again. If you don't, we'll tell your master. Also, we have decided to arrange for your wedding on our own, and if you do not come here, we will send the girl to you by bus. I say these things not to threaten you, but out of love. After all, am I not your own grandmother? And how I used to stuff your mouth with sweets. Also, it is your duty to look after Dharam and take care of him as if he were your own son. Now take care of your health, and remember that I am preparing lovely chicken dishes for you, which I will send to you by mail, along with the letter that I will write to your master. Your loving granny, Kusum." I folded the letter, put it in my pocket, and then slapped the boy so hard that he staggered back, hit the side of the bed and fell into it, pulling down the mosquito net as he fell. "Get up," I said. "I'm going to hit you again." I picked up the wrench and held it over him, then threw it to the floor. The boy's face had turned blue, and his lip was split and bleeding, and he still hadn't said a word. I sat in the mosquito net, sipping from a half bottle of whiskey. I watched the boy. I had come to the edge of the precipice. I had been ready to slay my master. This boy's arrival had saved me from murder and a lifetime in prison. That evening I told Mr. Ashok that my family had sent me a helper, someone to keep the car tidy. and instead of getting angry that he would now have to feed another mouth, which is what most of the masters would have done, he said, "He's a cute boy. He looks like you. What happened to his face?" I turned to Dharam. "Tell him." He blinked a couple of times. He was thinking it over. "I fell off the bus." "Smart boy." "Take care in the future," Mr. Ashok said. "This is great, Balram. You will have company from now on." Dharam was a quiet little fellow. He didn't ask for anything from me. He slept on the floor where I told him to. He minded his own business. Feeling guilty for what I'd done, I took him to the tea shop. "Who teaches at the school these days, Dharam? Is it still Mr. Krishna?"
"Yes, uncle."
"Is he still stealing the money for the uniforms and the food?"
"Yes, uncle."
"Good man." I went for 5 years and then Kusum Granny said that was enough. "Let's see what you learned in 5 years. Do you know the 8 times table?
"Yes, uncle."
"Let's hear it."
8 ones are 8.
"That's easy. What's next?"
8 twos are 16.
"Wait." I counted out on my fingers to make sure he had got it right. "All right. Go on. Order me a tea too, won't you?" Vitiligo Lips sat down next to me. He smiled at Dharam. "Order it yourself," I said. He pouted. "Is that any way for you to be talking to me, working class hero?" Dharam was watching us keenly, so I said, "This boy is from my village, from my family. I'm talking to him now."
8 threes are 24.
"I don't care who he is," Vitiligo Lips said. "Order me a tea, working class hero." He flexed his palm near my face. 5 fingers. That meant I want 500 rupees. "I've got nothing."
8 fours are 32.
He drew a line across his neck and smiled. "Your master will know everything. What's your name, boy?"
"Dharam." "What a nice name. Do you know what it means?"
"Yes, sir."
"Does your uncle know what it means?"
"Shut up," I said.
It was the time of the day when the tea shop got cleaned. One of the human spiders dropped a wet rag on the floor and started to crawl with it, pushing a growing wavelet of stinking ink-black water ahead of him. Even the mice scampered out of the shop. The customers sitting at the tables were not spared. The black puddle splashed them as it passed. Bits of bidis, shiny plastic wrappers, punched bus tickets, snippets of onion, sprigs of fresh coriander floated on the black water. The reflection of a naked electric bulb shone out of the scum like a yellow gemstone. As the black water went past, a voice inside me said, "But your heart has become even blacker than that, Munna." That night, Dharam woke up when he heard the shrieking. He came to the mosquito net.
"Uncle, what's going on?"
"Turn on the light, you fool! Turn on the light!" He did so, and saw me paralyzed inside the net. I could not even point at the thing. A thick-bodied grey gecko had come down from the wall and was on my bed. Dharam began to grin.
"I'm not joking, you moron. Get it out of my bed."
He stuck his hand into the net, grabbed the lizard, and smashed it under his foot.
"Throw it somewhere far, far away, outside the room, outside the apartment building."
I saw the bewildered look in his eyes. Afraid of a lizard? A grown man like my uncle? Good, I thought, just as he was turning off the lights. He'll never suspect that I'm planning anything. An instant later, my grin faded. What was I planning? I began to sweat. I stared at the anonymous palm prints that had been pressed into the white plaster of the wall. A cane began tapping on concrete. The night watchman of Buckingham Bee was doing his rounds with his long cane. When the tapping of the cane died out, there was no noise inside the room except for the buzzing of the roaches as they chewed on the walls or flew about. It was another hot, humid night. Even the roaches must have been sweating. I could barely breathe. Just when I thought I'd never go to sleep, I began reciting a couplet over and over again. I was looking for the key for years.
but the door was always open, and then I was asleep. I should have noticed the stenciled signs on the walls, in which a pair of hands smashed through shackles. I should have stopped and listened to the young men in red headbands shouting from the trucks, but I had been so wrapped up in my own troubles that I had paid no attention at all to something very important that was happening to my country. 2 days later, I was taking Mr. Ashok down to Lodi Gardens, along with Ms. Uma. He was spending more and more time with her these days. The romance was blossoming. My nose was getting used to her perfume. I no longer sneezed when she moved. So you still haven't done it, Ashok? Is it going to be like last time all over again?
It's not so simple, Uma. Mukesh and I have had a fight over you already. I will put my foot down. But give me some time. I need to get over the divorce.
Balram, why have you turned the music up so loud?
I like it loud. It's romantic. Maybe he's done it deliberately.
Look, it'll happen. Trust me, it's just...
Balram, why the hell haven't you turned the music down?
Sometimes these people from the darkness are so stupid.
I told you that already, Ashok.
Her voice dropped. I caught the words replacement, driver, and local in English. Have you thought about getting a replacement driver? A local driver?
He mumbled his reply. I could not hear a word, but I did not have to.
I looked at the rear-view mirror. I wanted to confront him eye to eye, man to man, but he wouldn't look at me in the mirror, didn't dare face me.
I tell you, you could have heard the grinding of my teeth just then.
I thought I was making plans for him. He'd been making plans for me. The rich are always one step ahead of us, aren't they?
Well, not this time. For every step he'd take, I'd take two.
Outside on the road, a street-side vendor was sitting next to a pyramid of motorbike helmets that were wrapped in plastic and looked like a pile of severed heads. Just when we were about to reach the gardens, we saw that the road was blocked on all sides. A line of trucks had gathered in front of us, full of men who were shouting,
"Hail the great socialist! Hail the voice of the poor of India!"
What the hell is going on?
Haven't you seen the news today, Ashok? They are announcing the results.
Fuck, he said. Balram, turn Enya off and turn on the radio.
The voice of the great socialist came on. He was being interviewed by a radio reporter.
The election shows that the poor will not be ignored. The darkness will not be silent. There is no water in our taps. And what do you people in Delhi give us? You give us cell phones. Can a man drink a cell phone when he is thirsty? Women walk for miles every morning to find a bucket of clean. Do you want to become Prime Minister of India?
Don't ask me such questions. I have no ambitions for myself. I am simply the voice of the poor and the disenfranchised.
But surely, sir,
let me say one last word, if I may. All I have ever wanted was an India where any boy in any village could dream of becoming the Prime Minister. Now, as I was saying, women walk for...
According to the radio, the ruling party had been hammered at the polls. A new set of parties had come to power. The Great Socialist's party was one of them. He had taken the votes of a big part of the darkness. As we drove back to Gurgaon, we saw hordes of his supporters pouring in from the darkness. They drove where they wanted, did what they wanted, whistled at any woman they felt like whistling at. Delhi had been invaded.
Mr. Ashok did not call me the rest of the day. In the evening he came down and said he wanted to go to the Imperial Hotel. He was on the cell phone the whole time, punching buttons and making calls and screaming.
We're totally fucked, Uma. This is why I hate this business I'm in. We're at the mercy of these...
Don't yell at me, Mukesh. You were the one who said the elections were a foregone conclusion.
Yes, you. And now we'll never get out of our income tax mess.
All right. I'm doing it, Father. I'm going to meet him right now at the Imperial.
He was still on the phone when I dropped him off at the Imperial Hotel. 42 minutes passed, and then he came out with two men. Leaning down to the window, he said, "Do whatever they want, Balram. I'm taking a taxi back from here. When they're done, bring the car back to Buckingham."
"Yes, sir."
The two men slapped him on the back. He bowed and opened the door for them himself. If he was kissing ass like this, they had to be politicians. The two men got in. My heart began to pound. The man on the right was my childhood hero, Vijay, the pig-herd son turned bus conductor turned politician from Laxmangarh. He had changed uniforms again. Now he was wearing the polished suit and tie of a modern Indian businessman. He ordered me to drive toward Ashoka Road. He turned to his companion and said, "The sister fucker finally gave me his car." The other man grunted. He lowered the window and spat. "He knows he has to show us some respect now, doesn't he?" Vijay chortled. He raised his voice. "Do you have anything to drink in the car, son?" I turned around. Fat nuggets of gold were studded into his rotting black molars. "Yes, sir." "Let's see it." I opened the glove compartment and handed him the bottle. "It's good stuff. Johnny Walker Black. Son, do you have glasses too?" "Yes, sir." "Ice?" "No, sir." "It's all right. Let's drink it neat. Son, pour us a drink." I did so, while keeping the Honda City going with my left hand. They took the glasses and drank the whiskey like it was lemon juice. "If he doesn't have it ready, let me know. I'll send some boys over to have a word with him." "No, don't worry. His father always paid up in the end. This kid has been to America and has his head full of shit, but he'll pay up too in the end." "How much?" "7. I was going to settle for 5, but the sister fucker himself offered 6. He's a bit soft in the head. And then I said 7, and he said okay. I told him if he didn't pay, we'd screw him and his father and his brother and the whole coal pilfering and tax-evading racket they have. So he began to sweat. And I know he'll pay up." "Are you sure? I'd love to send some boys over. I'd just love to see a rich man roughed up. It's better than an erection." "There will be others. This one isn't worth the trouble. He said he'll bring it on Monday. We're going to do it at the Sheraton. There's a nice restaurant down in the basement. Quiet place." "Good. He can buy us dinner as well." "Goes without saying. They have lovely kebabs there." One of the two men gargled the scotch in his mouth, gulped it in, burped and sucked his teeth. "You know what the best part of this election is?"
"What?"
"The way we've spread down south. We've got a foothold in Bangalore, too. And you know, that's where the future is."
"The south? Bullshit."
"Why not? One in every 3 new office buildings in India is being built in Bangalore. It is the future."
"Fuck all that. I don't believe a word. The south is full of Tamils. You know who the Tamils are? Negroes. We are the sons of the Aryans who came to India. We made them our slaves. And now they give us lectures. Negroes."
"Son," Vijay leaned forward with his glass, "another drink for me." I poured them out the rest of the bottle that night. At around 3 in the morning, I drove the city back to the apartment block in Gurgaon. My heart was beating so fast, I didn't want to leave the car at once. I wiped it down and washed it 3 times over. The bottle was lying on the floor of the car. Johnny Walker Black. Even an empty one is worth money on the black market. I picked it up and went toward the servants' dormitory. For a Johnny Walker Black, vitiligo lips wouldn't mind being woken up. I walked, rotating the bottle with my wrist, feeling its weight. Even empty, it wasn't so light. I noticed that my feet were slowing down, and the bottle was rotating faster and faster. I was looking for the key for years. The smashing of the bottle echoed through the hollow of the parking lot. The sound must have reached the lobby and ricocheted through all the floors of the building, even to the 13th floor. I waited for a few minutes, expecting someone to come running down. No one. I was safe. I held what was left of the bottle up to the light. Long and cruel and claw-like jags. Perfect. With my foot, I gathered the broken pieces of the bottle, which lay all around me, into a pile. I wiped the blood off my hand, found a broom and swept the area clean. Then I got down on my knees and looked around for any pieces I had failed to pick up. The parking lot echoed with the line of a poem that was being recited over and over. But the door was always open. Dharam was sleeping on the floor. Cockroaches were crawling about his head. I shook him awake and said, "Lie inside the mosquito net." He got in sleepily. I lay on the floor braving the cockroaches. There was still some blood on my palm. 3 small red drops had formed on my flesh, like a row of ladybirds on a leaf. Sucking my palm like a boy, I went to sleep. Mr. Ashok did not want me to drive him anywhere on Sunday morning. I washed the dishes in the kitchen, wiped the fridge and said, "I'd like to take the morning off, sir." "Why?" he asked, lowering the newspaper. "You've never asked for a whole morning off before. Where are you off to?" "And you have never before asked me where I was going when I left the house. What has Miss Uma done to you?" "I want to spend some time with the boy, sir, at the zoo. I thought you would like to see all those animals." He smiled. "You're a good family man, Balram. Go, have fun with the boy." He went back to reading his newspaper, but I caught a gleam of cunning in his eye as he went over the English print of the newspaper. As we walked out of Buckingham Towers B block, I told Dharam to wait for me, then went back and watched the entrance to the building. Half an hour passed, and then Mr. Ashok was down at the lobby. A small dark man of the servant class had come to see him. Mr. Ashok and he talked for a while, and then the small man bowed and left. They looked like 2 men who had just concluded a deal. I went back to where Dharam was waiting. "Let's go." He and I took the bus to the Old Fort, which is where the National Zoo is. I kept my hand on Dharam's head the whole time. He must have thought it was out of affection, but it was only to stop my hand from trembling. It had been shaking all morning, like a lizard's tail that has fallen off. The first strike would be mine. Everything was in place now. Nothing could go wrong. But like I told you, I am not a brave man. The bus was crowded, and the 2 of us had to stand for the entire journey. We both sweated like pigs. I had forgotten what a bus trip in summer was like. When we stopped at a red light, a Mercedes-Benz pulled up alongside the bus. Behind his upraised window, cool in his egg, the chauffeur grinned at us, exposing red teeth. There was a long line at the ticket counter of the zoo. There were lots of families wanting to go into the zoo, and that I could understand. What puzzled me, though, was the sight of so many young men and women going into the zoo, hand in hand, giggling, pinching each other and making eyes, as if the zoo were a romantic place. That made no sense to me. Now, Mr. Premier, every day thousands of foreigners fly into my country for enlightenment. They go to the Himalayas, or to Benares, or to Bodh Gaya. They get into weird poses of yoga, smoke hashish, shag a sadhu or 2, and think they're getting enlightened. Ha! If it is enlightenment you have come to India for, you people, forget the ganja, forget the ashrams, go straight to the National Zoo in the heart of New Delhi. Dharam and I saw the golden-beaked storks sitting on palm trees in the middle of an artificial lake. They swooped down over the green water of the lake and showed us traces of pink on their wings. In the background you could see the broken walls of the old fort. Iqbal, the great poet, was so right. The moment you recognize what is beautiful in this world, you stop being a slave. To hell with the Naxals and their guns shipped from China. If you taught every poor boy how to paint, that would be the end of the rich in India. I made sure Dharam appreciated the gorgeous rise and fall of the fort's outline, the way its loopholes filled up with blue sky, the way the old stones glittered in the light. We walked for half an hour from cage to cage. The lion and the lioness were apart from each other and not talking, like a true city couple. The hippo was lying in a giant pond full of mud. Dharam wanted to do what others were doing, throw a stone at the hippo to stir it up, but I told him that would be a cruel thing. Hippos lie in mud and do nothing. That's their nature. Let animals live like animals. Let humans live like humans.
That's my whole philosophy in a sentence. I told Dharam it was time to leave, but he made faces and pleaded, 5 minutes, uncle.
All right, 5 minutes.
We came to an enclosure with tall bamboo bars, and there, seen in the interstices of the bars, as it paced back and forth in a straight line, was a tiger. Not any kind of tiger. The creature that gets born only once every generation in the jungle. I watched him walk behind the bamboo bars. Black stripes and sunlit white fur flashed through the slits in the dark bamboo. It was like watching the slowed-down reels of an old black-and-white film. He was walking in the same line again and again, from one end of the bamboo bars to the other, then turning around and repeating it over at exactly the same pace, like a thing under a spell. He was hypnotizing himself by walking like this. That was the only way he could tolerate this cage. Then the thing behind the bamboo bars stopped moving. It turned its face to my face. The tiger's eyes met my eyes, like my master's eyes have met mine so often in the mirror of the car. All at once, the tiger vanished. A tingling went from the base of my spine into my groin. My knees began to shake. I felt light. Someone near me shrieked, "His eyes are rolling, he's going to faint!" I tried to shout back at her, "It's not true, I'm not fainting." I tried to show them all I was fine, but my feet were slipping. The ground beneath me was shaking. Something was digging its way toward me, and then claws tore out of the mud and dug into my flesh and pulled me down into the dark earth. My last thought, before everything went dark, was that now I understood those pinches and raptures. Now I understood why lovers come to the zoo. That evening, Dharam and I sat on the floor in my room, and I spread a blue letter before him. I put a pen in his hands. "I'm going to see how good a letter writer you are, Dharam. I want you to write to Granny and tell her what happened today at the zoo." He wrote it down in his slow, beautiful hand. He told her about the hippos and the chimpanzees and the swamp deer. "Tell her about the tiger." He hesitated, then wrote, "We saw a white tiger in a cage. Tell her everything." He looked at me and wrote, "Uncle Balram fainted in front of the white tiger in the cage." "Better still, I'll dictate. Write it down." He wrote it all down for 10 minutes. Writing so fast that his pen got black and oozy with overflowing ink, he stopped to wipe the nib against his hair and went back to writing. In the end, he read out what he had written. "I called out to the people around me, and we carried Uncle to a banyan tree. Someone poured water on his face. The good people slapped Uncle hard and made him wake up. They turned to me and said, 'Your uncle is raving. He's saying goodbye to his grandmother. He must think he's going to die.'" Uncle's eyes were open now. "Are you all right, Uncle?" I asked. He took my hand and he said, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry." I asked, "Sorry for what?" And he said, "I can't live the rest of my life in a cage, Granny. I'm so sorry." We took the bus back to Gurgaon and had lunch at the tea shop. It was very hot, and we sweated a lot, and that was all that happened today. Write whatever you want after that to her, and post it tomorrow, as soon as I leave in the car. But not before. Understand? It was raining all morning, a light, persistent kind of rain. I heard the rain, though I could not see it. I went to the Honda City, placed the incense stick inside, wiped the seats, wiped the stickers, and punched the ogre in the mouth. I threw a bundle near the driver's seat. I shut all the doors and locked them. Then, taking 2 steps back from the Honda City, I bowed low to it with folded palms. I went to see what Dharam was doing. He was looking lonely, so I made a paper boat for him, and we sailed it in the gutter outside the apartment block. After lunch, I called Dharam into my room. I put my hands on his shoulders. Slowly I turned him around so he faced away from me. I dropped a rupee coin on the ground. "Bend down and pick that up." He did so, and I watched. Dharam combed his hair just like Mr. Ashok did. with a part down the middle. When you stood up over him, there was a clear white line down his scalp, leading up to the spot on the crown where the strands of a man's hairline radiate from. Stand up straight. I turned him around a full circle. I dropped the rupee again. Pick it up one more time. I watched the spot, telling him to sit in a corner of the room and keep watch over me. I went inside my mosquito net, folded my legs, closed my eyes, touched my palms to my knees, and breathed in. I don't know how long I sat like the Buddha, but it lasted until one of the servants shouted out that I was wanted at the front door. I opened my eyes. Dharam was sitting in a corner of the room, watching me. "Come here," I said. I gave him a hug and put 10 rupees into his pocket. He'd need that.
"Balram, you're late. The bell is ringing like crazy."
I walked to the car, inserted the key, and turned the engine on. Mr. Ashok was standing at the entrance with an umbrella and a cell phone. He was talking on the phone as he got into the car and slammed the door.
"I still can't believe it. The people of this country had a chance to put an efficient ruling party back in power, and instead they have voted in the most outrageous bunch of thugs. We don't deserve..."
He put the phone aside for a moment and said, "First to the city, Balram. I'll tell you where." And then resumed the phone talk. The roads were greasy with mud and water. I drove slowly.
"Parliamentary democracy, Father. We will never catch up with China for this single reason."
First stop was in the city, at one of the usual banks. He took the red bag and went in, and I saw him inside the glass booth, pressing the buttons of the cash machine. When he came back, I could feel that the weight of the bag on the back seat had increased. We went from bank to bank, and the weight of the red bag grew. I felt its pressure increase on my lower back, as if I were taking Mr. Ashok and his bag not in a car, but the way my father would take a customer and his bag in a rickshaw. 700,000 rupees. It was enough for a house, a motorbike, and a small shop, a new life. My 700,000 rupees. "Now to the Sheraton, Balram."
"Yes, sir."
I turned the key, started the car, changed gear. We moved. "Play some Sting, Balram, not too loud."
"Yes, sir."
I put the CD on. The voice of Sting came on. The car picked up speed. In a little while, we passed the famous bronze statue of Gandhi leading his followers from darkness to the light. Now the road emptied. The rain was coming down lightly. If we kept going this way, we would come to the hotel, the grandest of all in the capital of my country, the place where visiting heads of state, like yourself, always stay. But Delhi is a city where civilization can appear and disappear within 5 minutes. On either side of us, right now, there was just wilderness and rubbish. In the rearview mirror, I saw him paying attention to nothing but his cell phone. A blue glow from the phone lit up his face. Without looking up, he asked me, "What's wrong, Balram? Why has the car stopped?" I touched the magnetic stickers of the goddess Kali for luck, then opened the glove compartment. There it was, the broken bottle with its claws of glass.
"There's something off with the wheel, sir. Just give me a couple of minutes."
Before I could even touch it, I swear, the door of the car opened. I was out in the drizzle. There was soggy black mud everywhere. Picking my way over mud and rainwater, I squatted near the left rear wheel, which was hidden from the road by the body of the car. There was a large clump of bushes to one side, and a stretch of wasteland beyond.
"You've never seen the road this empty. You'd swear it's been arranged just for you."
The only light inside the car was the blue glow from his cell phone. I rapped against his glass with a finger. He turned to me without lowering the window. I mouthed out the words, "There's a problem, sir." He did not lower the window. He did not step out. He was playing with his cell phone, punching the buttons and grinning. He must be sending a message to Ms. Uma. Pressed to the wet glass, my lips made a grin. He released the phone. I made a fist and thumped on his glass. He lowered the window with a look of displeasure. Sting's soft voice came through the window.
"What is it, Balram?"
"Sir, will you step out? There is a problem." What problem? His body just wouldn't budge. It knew, the body knew, though the mind was too stupid to figure it out. The wheel, sir. I'll need your help. It's stuck in the mud. Just then the headlights flashed on me. A car was coming down the road. My heart skipped a beat, but it just drove right past us, splashing muddy water at my feet. He put a hand on the door and was about to step out, but some instinct of self-preservation still held him back. It's raining, Balram. Do you think we should call for help? He wriggled and moved away from the door. Oh, no, sir. Trust me. Come out. He was still wriggling. His body was moving as far from me as it could. I'm losing him, I thought, and this forced me to do something I knew I would hate myself for, even years later. I really didn't want to do this. I really didn't want him to think, even in the 2 or 3 minutes he had left to live, that I was that kind of driver, the one that resorts to blackmailing his master. But he had left me no option. It's been giving problems ever since that night we went to the hotel in Jangpura. He looked up from the cell phone at once. The one with the big T sign on it. You remember it, don't you, sir? Ever since that night, sir, nothing has been the same with this car. His lips parted, then closed. He's thinking, blackmail? Or an innocent reference to the past? Don't give him time to settle. Come out of the car, sir. Trust me. Putting the cell phone on the seat, he obeyed me. The blue light of the cell phone filled the inside of the dark car for a second, then went out. He opened the door farthest from me and got out near the road. I got down on my knees and hid behind the car. Come over this side, sir. The bad tire is on this side. He came, picking his way through the mud. It's this one, sir, and be careful. There's a broken bottle lying on the ground. There was so much garbage by the roadside that it lay there looking perfectly natural. Here, let me throw it away. This is the tire, sir. Please take a look. He got down on his knees. I rose up over him, holding the bottle held behind my back with a bent arm. Down below me, his head was just a black ball, and in the blackness, I saw a thin white line of scalp between the neatly parted hair, leading like a painted line on a highway to the spot on the crown of his skull, the spot from which a man's hair radiates out. The black ball moved, grimacing to protect his eyes against the drizzle. He looked up at me. It seems fine. I stood still, like a schoolboy caught out by his teacher. I thought, that landlord's brain of his has figured it out. He's going to stand up and hit me in the face. But what is the use of winning a battle when you don't even know that there is a war going on? Well, you know more about this car than I do, Balram. Let me take another look. And he peered again at the tire. The black highway appeared before me once more, with the white paint marks leading to the crown spot. There is a problem, sir. You should have got a replacement a long time ago. All right, Balram. He touched the tire. But I really think we... I rammed the bottle down. The glass ate his bone. I rammed it 3 times into the crown of his skull, smashing through it to his brains. It's a good, strong bottle, Johnny Walker Black. Well worth its resale value. The stunned body fell into the mud. A hissing sound came out of its lips, like wind escaping from a tire. I fell to the ground. My hand was trembling. The bottle slipped out, and I had to pick it up with my left hand. The thing with the hissing lips got up onto its hands and knees. It began crawling around in a circle, as if looking for someone who was meant to protect it. Why didn't I gag him and leave him in the bushes, stunned and unconscious, where he wouldn't be able to do a thing for hours while I escaped? Good question. And I've thought about it many a night, as I sit at my desk, looking at the chandelier. The first possible reply is that he could always recover, break out of his gag, and call the police. So I had to kill him. The second possible reply is that his family was going to do such terrible things to my family. I was just getting my revenge in advance. I like the second reply better. Putting my foot on the back of the crawling thing, I flattened it to the ground. Down on my knees I went, to be at the right height for what would come next. I turned the body around so it would face me. I stamped my knee on its chest. I undid the collar button and rubbed my hand over its clavicles to mark out the spot. When I was a boy in Laxmangar, and I used to play with my father's body, the junction of the neck and the chest, the place where all the tendons and veins stick out in high relief, was my favorite spot. When I touched this spot, the pit of my father's neck, I controlled him. I could make him stop breathing with the pressure of a finger. The stork's son opened his eyes just as I pierced his neck, and his lifeblood spurted into my eyes. I was blind. I was a free man. When I got the blood out of my eyes, it was all over for Mr. Ashok. The blood was draining from the neck quite fast. I believe that is the way the Muslims kill their chickens. But then tuberculosis is a worse way to go than this, I assure you. After dragging the body into the bushes, I plunged my hands and face into the rainwater and muck. I picked up the bundle near my feet, the white cotton t-shirt, the one with lots of white space and just one word in English, and changed into it. Reaching for the gilded box of tissues, I wiped my face and hands clean. I pulled out all the stickers of the goddess and threw them on Mr. Ashok's body, just in case they'd help his soul go to heaven. And then getting into the car, turning the ignition key, putting my foot on the accelerator, I took the Honda City, finest of cars, most faithful of accomplices, on one final trip. Since there was no one else in the car, my left hand reached out to turn Sting off, then stopped and relaxed. From now on I could play the music as long as I wanted. In the railway station, 33 minutes later, the colored wheels in the fortune machines were coruscating. I stood in front of them, staring at the glowing and the whirling, and wondering, should I go back to get Dharam? If I left him there now, the police would certainly arrest him as an accomplice. They would throw him into jail with a bunch of wild men. And you know what happens to little boys when they get put into dens like that, sir. On the other hand, if I went back now all the way to Gurgaon, someone might discover the body. And then all this, I tightened my grip on the bag, would have been a waste. I squatted on the floor of the station, pressed down by indecision. There was a squealing noise to my left. A plastic bucket was tumbling about, as if it were alive. Then a grinning black face popped out of the bucket. A little creature, a baby boy, a homeless man and woman covered in filth, sat on either side of the bucket, gazing blankly into the distance. Between his fatigued parents, this little thing was having the time of his life, playing with the water and splashing it on passers-by. "Don't do it, little boy," I said. He splashed more water, squealing with pleasure each time he hit me. I raised my hand. He ducked into his bucket and kept thrashing from the inside. I reached into my pockets, searched for a rupee coin, checked to make sure it wasn't a 2-rupee coin, and rolled it toward the bucket. Then I sighed and got up and cursed myself and walked out of the station. "Your lucky day, Dharam,"